Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 24th of October 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish, and we're delighted to be joined by Vanessa Beely.
Well, we're going to get to start off, Brian, with the European Commission and Italy. And what's going on there is quite spectacular, because the European Commission has decided that Italy's draft budget is not satisfactory. And this is pretty important because, of course, Italy is one of the founding nations of the European Union. They're certainly in the Eurozone. And so this is not like Greece. This is not like the EU's intimidation of Greece and getting them to conform. So let's just have a look and see what the European Commission had to say yesterday.
And now let me move to the draft budgetary plans. And I would say it's with a lot of regret that I'm here before you today, because today, for the first time, the Commission is obliged to request a euro area country to revise its draft budgetary plan. But we see no alternative than to request the Italian authorities to do so. We have adopted an opinion giving Italy a maximum of 3 weeks to provide a revised draft budgetary plan for 2019. Unfortunately, the clarifications received yesterday were not convincing to change our earlier conclusions of a particularly serious non-compliance with the recommendation addressed to Italy by the Council on 13th of July.
So they've got 3 weeks, Brian, to come up with a new plan.
Yeah, genuine astonishment, because I hadn't seen that clip until we've just showed it. 3 weeks for a country to change its whole plan.
Its budget plan, yeah.
Budget plan simply on the say-so of the European Union. That's quite incredible. Could it be that it's not difficult to change the plan because the EU's already decided what it should be changed to?
Well, look, the plan really is that the EU, the European Commission, is complaining about the levels of debt that the Italian government are carrying, and they're saying that they've got to therefore put through an austerity program, just like Greece had to do. Italy isn't having any of it. This new government is not having any of it. And this is, I think, an existential threat to the Eurozone. Because it doesn't look like they're prepared to capitulate. So we watch this space with interest.
Yeah, particularly as, of course, the EU still driving for the overall treasury.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's move on to Russia then. And, well, John Bolton has been visiting Russia over the last few days. I have to say it's been a pretty positive meeting, so a series of meetings in general. And as you can see on screen, this is his meeting with President Putin yesterday. Now, what were they discussing? Well, Putin was sort of saying, you know, the United States being a bit aggressive and not really understanding, he said, why they're being aggressive. But nonetheless, what has been done is that they've agreed that Donald Trump and President Putin are going to meet on the 11th of November. This is a centennial of the end of the First World War. It's taking place in Paris. They're both going to be there, so they're going to get together and have a discussion while they're there. And the statement from the Russians was the presidents will hold a bilateral meeting. This will be a normal bilateral meeting. Well, nonetheless, during this meeting, Putin couldn't resist having a little bit of fun. So let's just have a brief look at what was said.
And now let me move to the draft.
I apologize. That's the wrong video.
Господин Болтон, уважаемые коллеги, мы рады видеть вас в Москве.
Distinguished Mr. Bolton, dear colleagues, we are glad to welcome you to Moscow.
В начале нашей беседы хотел бы вспомнить нашу встречу с президентом Соединенных Штатов в Хельсинки.
As we begin our meeting today, I would like to recall our meeting with the U.S. President in Helsinki.
Это была, на мой взгляд, полезная, местами достаточно жесткая встреча и беседа, но все-таки в конечном итоге, на мой взгляд, конструктивная.
This talk was, I believe, very fruitful. In some parts it was quite harsh, but in general, I believe it was a very constructive meeting.
И поэтому для нас, честно скажу, иногда удивительно видеть, как Соединенные Штаты предпринимают в отношении России абсолютно ничем не спровоцированные шаги, которые мы не можем назвать дружественными.
That is why, frankly speaking, I am quite surprised to see steps undertaken by the United States which are not substantiated by anything, and I do not think that they can be called friendly.
Насколько я помню, на гербе Соединенных Штатов изображен орлан.
As far as I remember, the coat of arms of the U.S. depicts an eagle.
С одной стороны он держит 13 стрел, а с другой стороны оливковую ветвь, как знак миролюбивой политики с 13 оливками.
On the one hand it holds 13 arrows, and on the other hand it holds an olive branch with 13 olives as the sign of the benevolent and peace-loving policy of the U.S.
Вопрос.
And here goes the question.
Ваш орлан уже все оливки склевал, остались одни стрелы.
Looks like your eagle has eaten all the olives, and what is left only the arrows.
So, Brian, classic Russian humor there. Maybe I could invite Vanessa onto the program. Welcome to the program, Vanessa. Putin couldn't resist, but this is a great example of Russian humor. They like to use it, and they're very good at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was actually transfixed by Lavrov's face next to Putin. Not quite sure if he knew the joke was coming, but he seemed to be quite prepared for it.
Yes. Well, speaking of Lavrov, he, as you say, was there. He had held talks with Bolton as well a couple of days ago, and he said the sides exchanged views on topical international problems, including the situation around Syria and Afghanistan, the conditions in Ukraine and on the Korean Peninsula. They also discussed prospects for cooperation between the countries, including in the interest of finding solutions to regional conflicts, efficient fight against terrorism, and maintaining strategic stability. So, you know, in general, I have to say that this meeting has been significantly positive and has gone beyond how it was being presented, really, which was only there to discuss the INF treaty, which was the nuclear treaty that Trump was making the threats about over the weekend. It's actually turned out to be something much broader than that, and has ended up in a bilateral meeting between Putin and Trump in a couple of weeks' time.
Is this because the US hasn't got its way in Syria, so they're now going to change tack and come in for more discussion? Possibly?
No, I think this is Trump playing his game and the mainstream media sort of painting that in a particular light, when in fact something completely different is going on.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's move on to Syria and Vanessa. We're going to start off with this. This is from RT a few weeks ago, I think. In August, RT published this, and they're saying ISIS al-Nusra hiding in Syria refugee camps. They say Islamic State, IS, formerly ISIS, and the al-Qaeda proxy group Jabhat al-Nusra found quiet shelter in one of the biggest camps, Rukban, near the Syria-Jordan border. Then if we go back to February, we had this comment from Sergei Lavrov saying it's clear that the United States has some strategy, which I believe entails staying in Syria forever with its armed forces. They're gearing up for separating a huge part of Syria from the rest of the country, violating Syria's sovereignty of territorial integrity. There they will create quasi-local authorities and will try to create autonomy based on the Kurds. And he went on to say, it's clear that the U.S. has some kind of strategy which I think stipulates staying in Syria with its armed forces for ages. They want to do the same thing now in Iraq and Afghanistan, despite all the promises made earlier. Vanessa, this is quite interesting that we've got IS and al-Qaeda members hiding in refugee camps. How do we then separate them out from the refugees?
Well, I mean, this is a common situation to a huge degree. I mean, the camp itself is Rukban camp, which is only, I think, about 11 miles south of the Al-Tanf U.S. military base. Now, bear in mind, recently, during the Sweda massacre at the end of July, which was carried out by ISIS militants that came in from the direction of the military base, so from the northeast of Sweda, which is in the south of Damascus. It's a known sort of protection policy by the US regarding the ISIS terrorist factions, in the sense that ISIS seized the entire area around Al Tanf base, and clearly Rukban refugee camp as a protected area. In other words, it's an area where they can camp, where they can gather their forces, where they can go to for protection, knowing that the Syrian Arab Army and its allies can't enter a certain protection zone or buffer zone around that US-held military area. So what is quite interesting with the Rukban camp, of course, even Peter Ford, the former UK ambassador to Syria, has confirmed in his update on the Syrian situation, which was published yesterday, that the camp itself is infested with ISIS and al-Qaeda terrorists. But as you've just pointed out, what is sort of very interesting is that the White Helmets have started advertising the fact on their Twitter pages that they would like to enter Rukban camp to take care of the refugees. So, okay, let's put those two facts together. The fact that Rukban camp is infested by ISIS and al-Qaeda, it's protected. It's basically a U.S. military base protectorate, only 11 miles away from the U.S. base, which is illegally inside Syrian territory on the borders with Iraq and Jordan. And now we have the White Helmets. We have Asad Hanna, who is the self-proclaimed media and advocacy manager for the White Helmets, putting out announcements that they would like to enter Rukban camp. Bear in mind also Asad Hanna contributes to Chatham House.
Okay, so here is the first one here from Asad Hanna. The White Helmets are ready to intervene at Rukban camp on the Syrian, Iraqi and Jordanian borders. The situation in this camp is so inhuman. Every day we're hearing of some people passing away due to the bad conditions. I think it will be incredibly important to have White Helmets there. And then the next tweet, he says, the humanitarian situation in Rukban camp is so bad. This is a camp in the triangle between Jordan, Iraq and Syria, has about 60,000 people, suffered from ISIS, Assad and Russia. No food or medical supplies. What they now need is intervention by the UN. And he includes in this particular tweet a map. And at the bottom there you can see that is Rukban camp right on the border there. So you know, my first question, Vanessa, is how would they get the White Helmets there, bearing in mind at the moment they're mostly in Idlib province, which is in the northwest, right?
Yeah, but don't forget that the White Helmets, when they were originally created, they have a training base in Jordan and in Turkey. So it would be very easy to get White Helmet operatives, maybe even some of those so-called White Helmet operatives that were given special evacuation by Israel into Jordan. You know, we still don't have complete figures of those that have come into the various host countries that were going to take care of their resettlement. The UK itself has been particularly clandestine over exactly who those White Helmets are. But what I would also say, and I think this is an important point, is that Rukban camp, the US and the UN push the humanitarian crisis. But if we consider the fact that this camp is largely inhabited by al-Qaeda and ISIS militants, and that camp is effectively under the control of the US because it's very hard for UN agencies to approach the camp without permission of the US, this is the sort of dilemma that we have here. So in other words, is this humanitarian crisis being manufactured by the US coalition in order to enable further occupation of that camp by intelligence assets? Of course, that includes the White Helmets. That has to be a serious consideration here. It also shows that despite Trump's protestations that he will withdraw from Syria, that in fact the opposite is happening. America is building up its presence inside Syria. It's maintaining Al Tanf base. It's suggesting to increase that to include Rukban camp. It is increasing its presence and military equipment supply to its proxy in the northeast, the SDF, which is the YPG. It is basically hovering in the shadows in Idlib, which is effectively occupied by al-Qaeda, in control of a number of lesser or so-called moderate factions. We've heard recently that the US is now agreeing to joint patrols in Manbij, which is west of the Euphrates, in order to control the Kurds that they are controlling to the east of the Euphrates. So basically what the US is doing here is maintaining a very strong military and illegal military presence in Syria. And Rukban, I think, is an extension of that.
And do you think, you know, when Putin and Trump get together, do you think that actually Russia has any opportunity or likely to succeed at all in persuading the United States this is not a direction they particularly want to take?
I think the difficulty, and I think what Peter Ford pointed out in his update, is that now the U.S. language seems to have been redirected towards basically erasing Iranian presence and alliance with Syria. So removing Iranian presence from inside Syria and potentially also from the borders with Iraq, and trying to break that alliance between Syria and Iran. And that puts Russia actually in quite a difficult situation, because while Russia has been clearly a very strong ally of Syria, Syria will not, I don't believe, relinquish its alliance with Iran. So this is going to be a very difficult and a very delicate negotiating process for Putin to try and maneuver his way through. However, I do think he is the consummate chess player, so I think it's well within his and Damascus' capability to do so.
Yeah. Okay, well, look, in a second, we're going to mention an article that you've just posted in the last couple of days on the 21st Century Wire website. But before we get to that, you had the opportunity to interview or to speak to some children in Sinjar. Sinjar, if I'm right, is in Idlib. Is that correct?
Sinjar is in eastern Idlib, so it's an area that is now back under control of the Syrian Arab Army, and a number of refugees from Idlib that's under the control of the HTS, which is effectively Tahrir al-Sham, which is a rebrand of al-Qaeda. People that are leaving are coming out through the Abu Dhuhr humanitarian corridor, which was set up by the Syrian government and the Russian reconciliation teams to enable civilians to leave Idlib safely before the military or before the potential military campaign. And these children, this entire family, we met in Sinjar.
And basically, you're asking them if they know anything about the white helmets, if they'd seen them. The people that wear white helmets, they said yes. They were asked, do you know them? They said yes. And they were asked, what do you know about them? What did they do? And they said they were militants. They used to carry weapons. Yes. You saw them. Yes. And so, you know, that's a pretty definitive statement that these children at least saw people with white helmets carrying weaponry.
Yeah, I mean, and this was, we interviewed the children actually at the end of the trip. This, what set off the interviewing of the children, you've just put this photograph up, was when I started to photograph this grandmother and the little boy who was sitting on her lap, he immediately burst into tears and became almost quite hysterical at the sound of the camera. So I asked the family, why is he so upset by the sound? It was the shutter sound. And the family told me, I have another interview with the mother of the little boy, and she said basically when the militants broke into people's houses and stole their belongings and quite often kidnapped family members for ransoms, and those that the family couldn't pay for were executed. She told us of one family where I think the father had been burned alive because the family couldn't raise the money for the ransom to release him. She told us that the white helmets entered the homes with the militant factions carrying cameras. And so the children from then on had associated the sound and the sight of the cameras with the violence and brutality of the militant factions. We interviewed all the family members, and at the end of the day, as I said, we actually approached the children who by then were a little more relaxed with us. What they told us, as you showed, is that for them, the white helmets were militants. There was no question about that. They carried arms. When we asked them what they meant by arms, they pointed to the guns of the guys who were with us. But they also told us in a separate interview that the white helmets kidnapped children, and for that reason, they were very afraid of them. They stayed away from them. That was confirmed by a male member of the family also, who told us that in the last 12 months, the White Helmets and the militant factions in Idlib had been responsible for the kidnapping of over 600 people, majority of whom were children.
People in the chat box commenting on the grandmother and the tattoos. Is this a tribal thing or what? What's going? What is that?
This is basically, I think, it's a tribal marking, which is common among some of the tribes in that area and in other areas in Syria. A friend of mine actually identified it, but I can't, for the life of me, remember the name of the tribe.
Yeah. Okay, well, which leads us on then to your article published 21st Century Wire. The headline is Syria Exclusive, Vanessa Bealey Meets the White Helmets and Armed Group Leader in Daraz al-Balad. How on earth did this come about? And, I have to say, bearing in mind the criticism that you have piled on the White Helmets over the years, were they even aware that you were in their presence?
They were told that I was an independent British journalist. So actually what that did is probably put them into a situation where they felt they could put on a performance in order to renew their funding, which they told me immediately had been had stopped since June this year. So since the reconciliation agreements came into effect in that area, in Daraa al-Balad, although actually Daraa al-Balad, which is the old city of Daraa, is a strange situation in the sense that there is a ceasefire, but many of the armed groups, the leader of which I actually met at the White Helmet Centre, have refused reconciliation. They've given up their heavy weapons and their medium weapons, but they've retained their light weapons, and they are still running protests at the Al-Amari Mosque every Friday. So that was also made very clear to me by Adham al-Qrad, who was leader of the engineering and missile regiment of the Free Syrian Army, the creator of a number of the, for example, the Omar rocket, the 500 kilo rocket that was used against civilian and military targets in Daraa during the battles to gain territory there by the extremist groups backed by the West. And the Syrian Arab Army and civilians in those areas. But what was, I think, the two points that came out of, or the points that came out of the meeting with the White Helmets, one, of course, in the article, and I won't go into all the depth, I'd recommend people do go and look at it. It's very long, and I apologize for that, but there's a lot of information in there. Two of the main points for me was that this White Helmet said to me that while, of course, he and their operation in Daraa al-Balad is completely clean, although I've disproven that in the article, in the sense of their clear affiliations to the Free Syrian Army and to Banyan al-Masus, which is the military operations group inside Daraa that carried out the massacre of the Syrian Arab Army soldiers in June 2017. And this White Helmet Center was responsible for the bringing back of those bodies, the dismemberment of those bodies, the putting of those bodies into plastic bags and dumping them on a local rubbish heap. But one thing that he did say was that the White Helmets that had exited by the Israeli special evacuation, of those that left, at least 50% were Nusra Front and other armed militant factions.
Sorry, just to clarify, those are the ones that left through Israel and ended up going to the UK and Canada in particular?
Yeah, absolutely. And what he also made the point, because we pushed him on the fact that there is evidence that a lot of the White Helmet groups have affiliations to Nusra Front, he basically said outright that while they had no affiliation to Nusra Front, other White Helmet groups might have Nusra Front leaders, and if they have Nusra Front leaders, then the entire group will be Nusra Front. Now, what is very interesting is that this is exactly what I have been saying since 2016, that if the White Helmet group is led by a Nusra Front leader, such as, for example, in East Aleppo, when they were led by Abdulaziz Maghribi, who was a militant member of Nusra Front and Abu Amara, then it would follow that the members of the White Helmet group under his command would also follow that extremist ideology. So effectively, this was a White Helmet operative confirming what I had suspected and vindicating my arguments for the last 4 years. He goes on to give actually quite a lot of other information couched in this performance that he gave on the basis that he considered me to be sympathetic to their cause because I was British. He admitted that they were funded. He didn't actually mention American funded. He clearly mentioned British funding. He said, although we're funded by the British, we don't follow British policy. But he admitted that they were pressured to follow British policy. So clearly, while he was trying to distance himself from his involvement in the White Helmet construct, which was created by British intelligence agencies, he very clearly was not able to do that.
Okay. Yeah, just one comment on that, Vanessa. Mm. At the moment you're talking policy, that's such a key subject. Where does the policy come that's being used to pressurise these people? And in the first instance, we've got to say it must come through the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. And even on the subject of defence, we're now looking at power and policy coming not through the Ministry of Defence, but through the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. And I think that's a subject which we're going to be looking at in a lot more detail.
Okay, Vanessa, we'll end this segment with you with this article that you've published in Mint Press. Now, this is one of, is it three articles at the moment? And the headline is The Oligarchs Behind the Humanitarian Regime Change Network Now Exploiting Joe Cox's Death to Push for UK Labour Split. So what are these articles on Mint Press, and what is the purpose of the series, just briefly?
Well, the purpose of the series was to basically bring together a lot of the research that I'd done previously into the creation of the Joe Cox Fund, which, of course, came into existence literally less than 24 hours after her dreadful murder. And when I looked at the originators of the Joe Cox Fund, it became very clear to me that this was not some sort of happenstance. So the three articles that I've written with the amazing Whitney Webb at Mint Press basically go into the billionaire oligarch network behind the Joe Cox Fund. And what is very interesting in this part three is that what we actually kind of almost stumbled upon was the fact that the US oligarchy, the billionaire network, is effectively influencing British politics. So while the UK and the US are screaming Russia interference in their elections, quietly behind the scenes, the billionaire complex is doing exactly the same thing in UK politics. And where that becomes very clear is with certain high-profile members of the Labour Party who are effectively attempting regime change within the Labour Party and following Blairite principles are being funded and are being promoted and supported by the same billionaire network that are supporting the White Helmets and the regime change operation inside Syria. So I think it's a very interesting subject to look into in greater depth.
Hopefully we will do that in the not-too-distant future. Mm-hmm. Vanessa, thank you very much for joining us today. Just briefly remind everybody how they could support you if they want to.
Yeah, I mean, it would be great if people could go to my Patreon account, Vanessa Beattie on Patreon. As I said before, $1 a month, anything that you can afford just helps me to keep doing what I'm doing and to get back to Syria and to places like that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us today. We will see you soon, no doubt. Let's just move on briefly. Quick advertisement for AV9.1, Democracy in Chains, taking place in the Crown Plaza Hotel in Kensington in London on the 2nd of December 2018. That's a Sunday. It's an all-day event. Tickets are available at alternativeview.co.uk, and you will be speaking at that.
Yes, this is true. And I'm just thinking to myself, Mike, that as we report the news we are at the moment, how incredible things are, not only in UK, but worldwide, how necessary it is for talks such as this one that Ian's putting on in order to get across what's happening. Yep. So I think it's going to be a very interesting event.
OK. And Ian R. Crane, I believe, is going to be in the studio tomorrow evening with Mark Steele on Humanity versus Insanity at 7:30. And Fracking Nightmare as usual at 9 p.m. So that's live programmes on the UK Column live stream tomorrow evening. Hope to see you there.
Yep, and let's bring this one up. We've got Christina England has got a very important event on Sunday the 11th of November starts at 9:30 in the morning. Now, the venue location is London W11, but the actual venue won't be released until very close to the event. We understand why, because many problems have happened before, but this is a very in-depth and a really knowledgeable group of speakers on the subject of vaccines. So have a look out for that, and if you can possibly attend, please do. Now, the other thing we'd just like to bring you up to date on is the Hofschroer case, and this is a few comments on Grandma B, as she's known, Peter Hofschroer's mother. Really terrible things happening around this elderly lady. So several of her old friends have been notified by York Social Services that she's been psychologically assessed as not benefiting from visits. So she's taken into a residential care home, not of her own free will, and then she's not going to benefit from visits.
Well, no, I'm not a psychiatrist, Brian, but maybe you could explain to me how anybody could ever not benefit from having the visits of friends and family?
Well, it's very difficult to provide an answer to that, except to say that, of course, the people it would benefit are the people that are holding her effectively hostage in this place. She continues to tell her son that actually she'd love to have people visiting her. And we've got a few more points we'll bring up on there. There's a suspicion she might soon be moved away from Haxby Hall, so that the public will not necessarily even know where she is. And the expression used on screen there is being held, because this is how it seems. She is not where she is of free will, and certainly not as far as what she is saying to her own son. The social worker covering her case is a Jane Richardson. And Peter is distraught at what's being done to his mother and says she's being treated worse than a murderer by being denied all contact with the outside world. Her 90th birthday is on the 13th of December, so we're saying cards are very welcome. And also we're encouraging people to ask questions about this case. And we're going to stress, as we always do, that if you're polite and reasonable, you're concise, you put your questions forward in a very reasonable way, that is the most powerful way that you can deal with it. And we know that all of the public bodies get very fearful when they think the large numbers of the public are starting to look in and ask the right questions. Mm. So if you feel motivated, elderly lady locked up in a so-called care home, this is not an unusual occurrence in UK. It's happening to thousands of elderly people across the country. If you would like to do something, then start to ask those questions, but please be reasonable. And on the back of that, I'll also just give one headline here on the ICSA child abuse inquiry. This is Nottingham Live reporting that the police commissioner and former social worker Paddy Tipping has been giving evidence at the inquiry. On the right of the screen is quite a lot of detail from Nottinghamshire Live, where they're talking about the people who've actually been called forward. You can freeze the screen to read that. But of course, the inquiry is saying that individuals who were abused at Beechwood Children's Home in Nottingham have come forward to give evidence. But that doesn't include Melanie Shaw. But as you can see from reading through this, everything is carefully orchestrated. So they don't need to interview Melanie Shaw, because they've interviewed other people and they've got a rough idea of what sort of happened to some of the children. The police who were running Operation Daybreak, the investigation into the abuses around Beechwood and other children's home, they, of course, have been allowed to give their evidence in front of the inquiry. And they've also been prepared to say in front of the inquiry that at a particular time when no real progress had been made, not surprisingly, they hadn't interviewed key witnesses, there was an attempt to shut down the operation. So I'm going to say that at the moment, there's a huge amount of information coming to us about the ICSA inquiry, about Beechwood, about abuse of children in Nottingham. We are working through this and we are putting some very detailed reports together. but that is going to take us a few days. So if you're feeling UK Column is not really reporting on this at the moment, I can assure you that a lot of work is going on behind the scenes. Some individuals are working every day on Melanie's case. And ultimately, I think we're going to be able to put forward a pretty accurate report on what has and what has not happened with regard to investigation of child abuse in Nottingham. Mm.
Okay, let's move on to defence. Well, there's the wonderful HMS Queen Elizabeth on screen. That, of course, video was taken last week when, last week when it was visiting New York. Well, today the King and Queen of the Netherlands are visiting Downing Street for the first time, and they're having a working lunch with Theresa May, so they're probably meeting as we speak, and they've announced, or they're announcing, that the Netherlands has become one of the first nations to say that they intend to sail alongside Queen Elizabeth in her first deployment in 2021. I think this is exactly what we said would happen, Brian. We said that the Royal Navy does not have the ships to create a carrier fleet, and that therefore we would need to be working with European nations in order to do this. And that seems to be what's happening. So Dutch warship, they don't define what size of warship or what type of warship, will participate in the carrier strike group. And it's going to be one of the cornerstones of NATO's defence capability in the years ahead. So if the government is to be believed here, then a unified EU military force is going to be a cornerstone of NATO's defence capability. Maybe we're getting a clue as to what this future relationship between the EU and NATO is going to be. But at this working lunch they're holding today, the Prime Minister is going to announce that defence and security cooperation with the Netherlands, both bilaterally and through NATO, is going from strength to strength as we continue to negotiate a deep security partnership with the EU post-Brexit. Couldn't get clearer than that. She said the Netherlands is one of our closest allies. As we leave the European Union, we will continue to stand side by side to defend against threats to the global rules-based system. So there you go. That is what's going on there.
Just add to that, remarkable that the Royal Navy itself would allow another nationality, albeit the Dutch, who are regarded with high regard by the military, they come in and announce they're going to be helping to escort the carrier before the Royal Navy's even said what units it's going to be used to, what units it will use to escort the carrier. So I think there's an unnatural haste to get in a European aspect. But as we discussed before the news, it's interesting that the reality is this is a European operation. But every time it's mentioned in the press, it's cloaked in NATO. Mm. So it's an amorphous beast. And the other thing, of course, is we know that a lot of this policy is coming out of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, not the Ministry of Defence. And the group we are particularly interested in is the European Atlantic Group. Mm. So Ministry of Defence pushed to one side. It's the Foreign and Commonwealth Office bringing in the European unified military structure. And if we say how desperate are the is the British government at the moment to keep everything on this quiet, let's have a look at this letter. Now, this was published in the Times and it's created quite a lot of furore. So let's have a look at what it's about. If we bring this up on screen, essentially, it's a letter written in by some very senior retired military officers. I'll read it very quickly. We welcome the interventions of Lord Armstrong of Ilminster and Lord Butler of Brockwell, impartiality in the civil service letter, October 20th. We're certainly critical of Theresa May, a diminished prime minister. In terms of Lord Armstrong's arresting analogy, it is rightly the prime minister's duty as organ grinder to control the boy organ grinder Oliver Robbins and his monkey Alastair Brockbank. And if she lacks the grip to deliver a people's vote, then surely now is the time to hand over to a Conservative who can unpick the mess that she's made. The civil service is not what it was in the day of Armstrong and Butler, diminished by merry-go-mandarin appointments that have undermined department loyalty and expertise. It has a more partisan senior leadership. Robbins is the product of this recent culture, a return towards the status quo, and say might in time restore civil service confidence and confidence in the civil service. And if we look at the names of the people who apparently wrote this letter, we've got some very big hitters. There's Major General Julian Thompson, former Royal Marine, head of the Royal Marines, chairman now for Veterans of Britain, Rear Admiral Roger Lane Knott. We've got a Gwynthian Prince, academic board member, and Sir Richard Dearlove, the former chief of the Secret Intelligence Service. So what's so special about this letter? Well, what's so special is the red box is the bit that mysteriously changed between the letter being written and it being published by the Times. Let's have a look at how this was done. So this is the original phrase that the authors of the letter used. If the Prime Minister lacks the grip to deliver the will of the people's vote 2016, then surely now is the time to hand over. And after going through the hands of the Times letters team, it became this. If the Prime Minister lacks the grip to deliver a people's vote, then surely now is the time to hand over.
And the key point here is that people's vote, a people's vote, is the brand of the next referendum.
Is the second referendum.
Yes.
So what they've done is to take the meaning from saying the people have voted and the government needs to follow through their vote, which is to leave the European Union, and mysteriously, with some crafting, the sentence now reads the exact opposite. And quite rightly, Veterans for Britain have been pretty shirty about this. They say the first version clearly shows that the signatories are referring to the referendum in 2016 as the people's vote. And now it's changed to actually appearing to support the idea of a second referendum. We spoke to the Times this morning and they said, well, the changes were approved by Major General Julian Thompson, to which we said, even that one particular sentence, then it got a bit wobbly. They said they would come back to us with a response by email, which I don't believe we've received as yet. But Veterans for Britain say that some changes were discussed with the paper, but that he was not alerted to this particular change. So this is pretty, it seems, either an incredible mistake by such a high-profile paper or something pretty dirty was going on here. Is it possible it was a mistake? I don't think it was. And let's remember Dave Barnby and his book, The EU, A Corporatist Racket. If you haven't read this book, it is outstanding. It's very small, very easy to read. And in the book, using the government's own paperwork, it shows how there was a plan to manipulate what was reported in the press and media in order to take Britain into the EU in the first place. And that included playing around with letters submitted as if they were from members of the public. Mm. So we're just going to reinforce that. And we're also going to say that things now with the military are so serious. We have nearly lost control of the military under EU military unification. And the UK column is assisting an emergency defence briefing where we're going to be talking about what's really happening with this. This is really how we see the situation. The EU military unification, including the UK, is proceeding via the UK government and the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, despite government claims of Brexit, in or out, as we're supposed to possibly be, but that out is not an out. In or out of the EU, Britain, the Conservative government is handing control of our military research and development, procurement and defence industries to the EU. Without a sovereign military, the UK will no longer exist as an independent nation state. And since defence is tied in with security, it's not just about troops, it is also about policing of the United Kingdom. We cannot put it more strongly that if the government can get this subterfuge through, which is talk Brexit, but hand the whole of Britain's EU military structure to the EU, we simply do not exist as a country. So the emergency briefing is going to take place on Saturday, the 3rd of November. Start time, 12 o'clock. It'll be at the Seven Stars Hotel, Totnes, Devon, TQ9, 5DD. Tickets, £5 on the door, might be slightly more, but it will be a very modest charge because this is such a such an important briefing. And we're going to ask for as much help as possible from our viewers and listeners to help promulgate this event at such short notice.
Yep. So we'll leave it there.
Yeah. Okay.
No, we'll leave it there.
Oh, we'll leave it there. Yeah. That, leave it there. Yeah. Okay. Well, I suppose that is a good place to leave it, isn't it? Okay. If you're not already a subscriber of UK Column, please do consider taking out a subscription. We'd like to thank people who've donated to us. Your financial support is needed for us to do what we do and for us to improve what we do. So thank you for that support. We'll be back at the same time, losing track of my week now on Friday. Yeah. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.